I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Government debt and spending have been the focus of much political debate and discussion over the last few years. Even some economists are divided about how to rein in government spending and pay down the debt. But what about the $24 trillion in consumer and business debt that dwarf the public debt? Why has that gotten so much less attention? Our guests Steve Clemens and Richard Vague co-authored a report titled How to Predict the Next Financial Crisis, looking at some of the parallels between the Great Depression and the Great Recession and the role of private debt. They're speaking at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia this afternoon, just down the street from the WHYY studios, and they join us here in our WHYY studios. Steve Clemens is Washington Editor-at-Large of The Atlantic. He's also the publisher of the popular political blog, The Washington Note, and he's a senior fellow of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. And Steve Clemens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Also with us, as I said, Richard Vague, managing partner of Gabriel Investments. He co-founded, led, and sold two credit card companies, First USA and Juniper Financial. He's also the editor of the blog and email newsletter service called DelanceyPlace.com and the website debt/econ. I knew I was going to stumble over all this, debt/economics.org. And Richard Vague, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
Steve, let me begin with you. And we have done so many programs over the last couple of years about, you know, the public debt, government spending, government debt. But it's so interesting that this private debt that is so much larger than the public debt has gotten so much less attention. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that it's easier for publics to complain sometimes what their governments are doing, and there's some part of it. But if you look at countries like Japan, or you look at what's been happening and unfolding for quite a long time now in Europe, what you have are crises that occur in the private debt markets, as we saw in the United States with the subprime crisis. So you have an event that happens in the private sector, and then governments respond. And so what happens is, as those governments respond, that private sector event, which was only touching some number of people, gets a response that now touches everyone who pays taxes. Mm. And so it's the broad nature of the inclusion that everyone's now a stakeholder in the decisions government makes. And I think that's what has drawn so much of the attention to the wrong, in our view, the wrong part of the problem.
So, Richard Vague, how worried should we be about private debt? And it totals $24 trillion. And as your paper says, it's consumer debt, but it's also, I guess, business debt as well.
It's about half and half. It's $25 trillion, roughly half consumer and half business. And there have been two times in the last century that private debt has exceeded 150% of GDP. And once was during the 20s. Which we know led to the 1929 financial crisis. And the only other time was in the 2000s, right before the 2007 Great Recession.
And that debt, as you said, caused both the recession and the depression. But you also write about just the speed of the debt. I mean, that was sort of part of what caused these cataclysms.
Yeah, I mean, specifically mortgage debt was increasing at about 16% per decade from 1960 to 2000. And then all of a sudden it grows at 70% in a decade. It's like the proverbial hockey stick when you graph it. It was way more debt. I would call it runaway lending or binge lending. And all of a sudden you had a lot of debt that couldn't be repaid. And the same thing happened in the 20s.
And how much, Steve, have people, I guess, reined in their spending or dealt with their own individual debt or businesses dealing with their own individual debt?
Well, what's really interesting when you look at the profile of private debt in the country today is that there has, you know, we have the stories out there of, you know, private households, those that have the ability to pay down debt have paid down debt and they've deleveraged to a certain degree in some more. But when you look at the aggregate level, we're back up to the same level of debt that we were before the 2007 financial crisis, 2008 financial crisis. And I find that a disconcerting figure that there is a kind of myth that we've deleveraged and we're back and situated for growth. But when you look at where the spring is going to come in this, you know, the step of the U.S. economy, it's very hard to see how, if you're going to go on and take what is traditionally a releveraging or going out and amassing larger and larger loans to drive growth, where the room is for that. It is a it is something that I think is a problem, and that's what led us to take a look at these numbers and data, not only for the recent issue, but also look at historically. And what's really interesting after the Great Depression is you had values on of the loans in the financial institutions and banks really crunched down. And it was from that very crunch base. A lot of harm was done in the economy, but at the same time, we had massive growth after. So what we've largely seen in the U.S. economy is an ability to hide this, you know, ball and chain of debt in the system and never really digest it and knock it back down to real values.
And I do want to get to that, but even some basic information from your perspective, Richard Vague, even as a business person, is there good debt and bad debt, even when we're talking about things like private debt?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't say good or bad about debt, but one of the observations that we make, if you look back over the last 100 years or 200 years, is that almost without exception, GDP does not grow unless debt grows at a rate that is actually faster than GDP. So debt growth is necessary for GDP growth. The issue is when you get to the kind of levels we're at now. Private debt to GDP was 50% in 1950. It's 160% today. It's more than tripled, really, in my lifetime. And that's some clue as to how old I am, by the way.
Hey, join the club. Go ahead.
But at any rate, you're at a level now, as Steve has just mentioned, where you know we haven't come back down to a level we can grow from. If we grow from here, which we can, we're just going to be compounding some future problem.
But if we're thinking about personal or private debt, I'm assuming we're talking about credit card debt, mortgages,
student loans,
maybe even some of the debt that people get into paying for their health care coverage, things like that.
It's mainly mortgage debt.
Of
the 12 or 13 trillion in consumer debt, you know, 9 or 10 trillion of it is mortgage debt.
And does that go back to the bursting bubble, I guess the bubble and then the bursting bubble of the mortgage market?
That's right.
One of the things you say in this paper is take a look at debt and take a look at principal and begin to think about how to bring down this debt. How would that work, Steve?
Well, what we suggest is that there is a problem now that banks and financial houses that hold this debt don't have an incentive, the kinds of incentives that we think are necessary to write down these loans, keep people in their homes, allow people a kind of pathway out of their debt nightmares. And to a certain degree, it is a process of debt forgiveness, if you will. And you know, it's interesting to be here with a, you know, Republican businessman who was sort of king of the American credit card business
talking about this.
Richard Vague, sure. But basically talking about debt forgiveness in a way as a way to get back to a healthy strategy. That doesn't let everybody off, but it gets them into a place. But the banks and financial institutions don't have an incentive to do it because if they write down these loans to the degree that they really reflect the real value, they then undermine their capital ratios,
sure,
their loan ratios. And what we're proposing is that regulators come in and provide that window and a runway over, 10 to 15 to 20 years and say, you can take this, X box of loan portfolios, write them down to real values, keep people in their homes, give them a chance to work out. You forgive that debt, but you, bank, you get to write it down over 15, 20 years. That's not allowed today under current rules.
Well, let me put
and that's a problem.
So our listeners, so I understand this as well. Let's say you bought a house for $150,000. It's now worth $100,000. So you're underwater, right?
Yeah, right.
Using your formula, how would that work then for an individual that owns that house?
We would get that loan written down to $100,000.
Right.
Reflected on the bank's books, not only reflected on the bank's books, but basically a new deal done with that loan holder that forgives that person the $50,000, gets them back to something where they are, able to pay on the real value of that loan. So it gives them a substantial break.
Right.
Now, what happens is, and the reason this isn't happening, is that bank doesn't want to recognize that $50,000 loss.
Because for them, it's
but
a
if
loss,
we say to them,
it?
They can, it's a loss. But banks do this all the time. I mean, one of the things I've learned from Richard Vague, who is, was one of the nation's leading bankers, is banks restructure loans for commercial properties all the time. And this is no different than that. The problem is the scale was so enormous that it is impossible to conceive a way that keeps a lot of these banks solvent under the current rules.
Right.
And so they need to have a runway we would argue that allows them to write off these loans. And you know, perhaps a nudge, because there's a public interest dimension to this, in the sense that, you know, those folks that are suffering still today because of the result of the financial crisis are not suffering because of things they did themselves. To some degree, they're suffering from structural corruption that hit Washington and the kind of broad mortgage business. And so to fix this and get it out, we need to, you know, Richard and I found this great book on debt by David Graeber, who was educated on something called Jubilee at a certain
point.
Reading
about
that.
Yeah,
yes. And
it goes back to the Bible.
Yeah,
doesn't
it goes back to the Bible, that you have a traditional, was it every 7 years, Richard? You follow this better than I did, but you give people an opportunity. Now, I think the question is not institutionalizing people walking away from what they have, but in this particular case, with this particular crisis, it was so substantial. Right. We can fix a lot and get people back in a position where you're now healthy and able to re-leverage and take loans again and then drive economic growth. So it's the fastest way back to getting healthy economic growth in the United States again.
Rich Vega, is that a hard sell to these banks that hold some of these mortgages?
It's almost an impossible sell. I mean, you know, we're not naive about that. There's moral hazard is instantly invoked anytime you talk about something like this.
And which is kind of reinforcing bad behavior, right?
Right. Hazard. You forgive somebody for bad behavior and they go do it again. Well, there was forgiveness to financial institutions. And let's not just focus on banks, because I think of these mortgages, less of them are held by banks than are held out in other institutions. So it's a much broader question than that. But you really have two ways to go. You can either have these folks pay this down over time, and that's money that's not available for them to spend on, you know, vacations and trips and cars and all the other things we want that would drive GDP. So you can make them pay it down over time, or you can restructure those loans. You can take your pick. In one of the scenarios, forward economic growth is going to be much stronger. And so we're thinking about it systemically rather than morally.
Right. And morally gets us back to that moral hazard, the idea, and this was raised, of course, with the bailout of the financial institutions on Wall Street, which is, you know, are you reinforcing bad behavior that obviously created the mess that we're in today?
You can be a moral purist, and you could have never forgiven the banks, even though they were, you know, things like TARP were a bailout that covered up bad behavior. You could have not done that. You could not do anything for consumers. But you're going to have 160% debt to GDP, and you're going to have a slower growing economy for a generation or two. This is not something that's cyclical every 20 years. This is something that's been building up since World War II. And prior to that, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, you had one big buildup from, let's say, 1820 to 1930, and the second big buildup from post-World War II to the present. This isn't just a little cyclical, this will happen a couple times in our lifetime kind of a thing. This is epical.
But also sounds like epical and happening on a speedier basis as well.
Yeah, it happened a little bit. You know, a lot of this buildup occurred from 1960 forward. You know, a concentrated amount occurred in just the 6 year period 01 to 07.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Our guests are Richard Vague and Steve Clemens. We are talking about private debt, and it's about $24-25 trillion. What to do about it? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
It's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Blogg. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY-TV, online at whyy.org, and right here on WHYY-FM.
Inishnua Theatre Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting Scottish playwright D.C. Jackson's My Romantic History, directed by Tom Ring, now through February 24th at the Off Broad Street Theatre, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Steve Clemens and Richard Vague about an article that they wrote recently in The Atlantic that forgiving or even restructuring private debt could do more to help grow the economy than government spending. In fact, private debt, which includes consumers and businesses, dwarfs public debt. Public debt, of course, getting most of the attention and most of the criticism. Steve Clemens is Washington editor-at-large of The Atlantic, and Richard Vague, a managing partner at Gabriel Investments. And we looks like we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So going back to this this individual person, so let's say their mortgage is taken down to $100,000. So that means that their monthly payments are less. You are both arguing that that then allows that consumer to spend some of their money on the rest of the economy, and that would be a good thing for the economy. That would help to grow the economy. Do I have that right?
That's absolutely right. And if we could just see systemically a way to lighten the load of debt on the back of American consumers, that, to be honest, banks and financial institutions largely already understand and know. And so what we're trying to do is actually just make the market, clear the market, so that debt load comes off that mortgage holder, and that they can get back to living their lives and spending, and doing so in a way that doesn't, continually build a hole that they shouldn't be in. And I think that there's both a moral dimension to this, but there's also a very important economic one, which is that now allows the economy to really begin to bounce again.
And is that a more effective way of infusing money into the economy than government spending, than some of these stimulus programs that
we find, and Richard can walk through this very well, but that when you compare, say we take Paul Krugman, Paul Krugman writes a lot about spending and stimulus, and you look at basically the multiplier you get for that kind of government-led stimulus, whatever it may be, bailing out states or, programs or finding, however those dollars go out, that gets you less multiplier. It actually adds to the debt load of the nation, which is also a factor in drag, rather than writing down this debt where you get an instantaneous bump with far greater echo effects, positive echo effects in the economy.
You want to put some flesh on that, Richard?
Well, say it differently. $1 trillion in debt restructuring is easily equal to, if not better than, $1 trillion in government stimulus, and it has the benefit of not adding yet again to the debt burden. You end up with $1 trillion less rather than $1 trillion more in aggregate debt.
I mean, this seems, at least on the face of it, so simple. I mean, it makes so much sense. Why do you think there hasn't been more traction on this?
Well, I think it all gets back to this moral hazard question. I think any of these discussions goes almost nowhere almost immediately because there's so many objections to it on those kinds of bases.
Right. And perhaps it's even personal, because people that bought a house but maybe were in a better situation, able to afford those payments, they don't get the same kind of assistance as someone who got in over their head.
There's the issue of fairness. And we don't pretend to be able to address all those issues because, this guy was disciplined and didn't do it, this guy wasn't and did, and this bank wasn't and did, et cetera, et cetera. All I'm saying is, in aggregate, 160% private debt to GDP is weighing us down. It's an unprecedented level. And by the way, this is not just in the U.S. You see this problem globally. It is the same exact problem in Europe. And if you want to reduce it, there's two ways to do it. You can get folks to pay it down, which has a decreasing effect on GDP, or you can restructure.
And I know the Obama administration had their program to try to deal with some of these underwater mortgages. It didn't go very well or very far, but it wasn't really focused on the principal, was it, Steve?
No, and I think that it was a very ineffective program. I know people who, found themselves underwater just dealing, drowning in the paperwork and recalcitrant banks and dealing with this. And we just argue, look, let clear the market by by creating a regulatory runway that allows the write-off of this debt to market levels and allows them to take that over a period of time. Mm. It's a structural fix that changes the dynamics of writing down this debt, I think, dramatically. And so, you know, without getting in the issues of moral hazard and fairness, what you're allowing the market to do is to move to where the market needs to go,
right.
which it can't. It's sort of stuck in its, you know, kind of has blockages. And to some degree, we're arguing if you remove these blockages and find a pathway. And I think, you know, one of the reasons is just people haven't talked very much about this equation because, as we've seen, overwhelming interest, and we're going to hear about that tonight from the president in his State of the Union address, not only about, you know, how to grow the economy, but also as a fundamental piece of this is going to be this path towards austerity and spending reductions. And we're saying, okay, that's fine, mm-hmm. but that's really not as efficacious as some of these other fixes could be in dealing with a very substantial and historic level of mortgage debt that still hasn't cleared. And still that debt, despite the mythology of deleveraging in the U.S., still rests on the back of American mm-hmm. households. And it shouldn't.
And I was asking Richard about if this is a hard sell in the banking and business community. Is this a hard political sell, do you think, Steve Clemens?
I am of mixed minds in it. I think that as you get in and deal with you know, regulators and sectors, they are averse to changing what they do and changing, and they don't see themselves as complicit. But I'll tell you, one area that I'm worried is that I worry that we continue to have, let's take it away from the private household. We've
sure.
got a lot of commercial debt, you know, commercial real estate debt out there that I think is engaged in a game we call pretend and extend, where it's on the financial institution's balance sheets and the loans are being paid, but the value of that commercial real estate is substantially lower, but it hasn't been recognized because it hasn't sold. So the regulators come in and they pretend that the loan is solvent, and they extend the loan so that it doesn't hit. And you have a complicity between regulators and those financial institutions, just as we had complicity in the housing crisis.
Well, I was just going to
so
say that sounds very familiar.
History. Absolutely. And
well,
so I'd like to use some of that leverage there for what I think is going on to say, look, let's get something that's healthier for both sides of the equation, for the financial institutions, for the loan holders, and to create this. And, yeah, there may be some moral hazard problems, but they certainly should not get in the national interest way of clearing this debt and restoring the economy
you
back
want,
to a growth.
Go ahead, Richard Vig.
You know, there was a very important parallel in the Latin American debt crisis in the 80s that Paul Volcker really interceded in. He came in at a point where banks had lent a massive amount relative to their own capital. He and very quietly got them together and allowed them to write it out off over time. And it kind of took care of the problem. Something like that could have been done, I think, but the moment may have passed. I mean, if somebody had come in with that kind of clarity, you know, Volcker-like clarity in 07 or 08, said, okay, guys, you do this, you do this, you do this, including writing off all those loans, but I will give you 20 years, you know, put it as an asset on your book, mm-hmm. as regulators sometimes do, and then amortize it over 10 or 20 years. I think you've been able to do this fairly easily because everybody had such a sense of urgency. I don't think that's there anymore.
But do you think another operative word is it was done quietly? I don't know if you can do anything quietly anymore, if you know what
point.
I mean.
It's an excellent point. You know, it's almost inconceivable that that would have happened. You know, the guys in the meeting with Volcker would have been tweeting it.
Well, exactly. And then someone would have been retweeting it, and then, you know, right. there you go. Do you think that's part of you cover Washington, you're in Washington, Steve, that just it does feel as if we have a political system that is either unable or incapable of dealing with some of our serious problems?
Well, it's almost becoming a cliche, and I wish it wasn't that way. I'm actually writing a piece right now testing some of those assumptions, and because when I do listen to President Obama and Eric Cantor, and see, you know, if you really get beyond the political and partisan stuff, you really hear them at least framing some of the challenges, fiscal challenges for the country in the same way. So the gap between both sides is smaller than many people think. And I guess maybe I'm naive, and I think that there is an opportunity for bipartisanship in some of these issues to bounce back, particularly in the energy area and others. But don't underestimate the power of inertia in Washington, that inertia and vested interests are 90% of the game. And so you ask, you know, could we impact the regulatory environment? To some degree, it's simply exposing people who are in decision-making roles to alternative models for thinking about these issues. And, you know, I come out of the think tank business, and part of what the Washington think tank sector is. And think tanks are not well understood around the country, but they are a very powerful part of the political equation in Washington. They generate different ideas. They are often homes for governments in exile. And at that point, when you're generating what kind of alternatives are, we just had Jim DeMint leave the U.S. Senate and go to Heritage. Take Heritage Foundation. So these become incubators for ideas, or at least places to put on some theater, if you will, about alternative policy options. And I think that in our paper and with what Richard and I are doing, in fact, on March 13th in Washington, we're doing a conference with about 1,000 people attending. Paul Volcker mm-hmm. will be there. And this will be one of the big issues that we put on the table, is saying, why aren't we looking at alternative ways to get the debt load off the back of the American household and consumer, and give them another option that would be really extraordinary and create a lot of economic potential. And as I sit down with Senator Manchin, if I sit down with other senators that are out there, they don't think this is a crazy idea. Hmm. So, you know, that's the way change begins to move. But we're not, you know, you still have to work through inertia, you have to work through vested interest, and the general sludge that is very much a part of the, you know, D.C. swamp.
Well, this may be a very naive question on my part. Does the public play any role in this discussion?
I never like to underestimate the importance of the public. But in these issues, which can get fairly in the weeds, I think that the public can matter in spikes. They can come in and you see it through social media. You can see that I found in these issues, it's very hard to get sustained interest from the public in these kind of issues, but they can matter in spikes. And you can have a spike of interest. And that's enough. Mm-hmm. That's fine with me.
And that's Steve Clemens. He's Washington Editor-at-Large of The Atlantic, also the publisher of The Washington Note, a senior fellow of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, one of those think tanks that he just referenced. Also with us, Richard Vague, managing partner of Gabriel Investments. He lives and works here in the Philadelphia area. He is the editor of the blog and email newsletter, newsletter service, DelanceyPlace.com, and of the website debt/economics.org, and they are also co-founders of the Iraq Study Group, which I learned as we were discussing this program today. They also co-authored an article called How to Predict the Next Financial Crisis, and it looks at the role of private debt, the role that it played in bringing down some parts of our economy, and what can be done to use private debt and address the problem of private debt to get the economy going again. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Let me see what Tony from Pottstown has to say. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Yes. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Yes.
I'm well, thank you. I just wanted to make a point in regards to Iceland and how they approach this issue and actually putting the banksters and the ones in control of the private debt in jail for what they did. You know, talking about morals, that seems like it's a crime when someone loses their house because they can't pay even though they want to. But I just wanted to see what your guests had to say on that, you know.
No, it's a good question.
I'll take my comments off the air.
Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You were kind of nodding, Steve, as he was calling in. And this has come up, which is that almost nobody, at least in the sort of muckety-muck part of the our financial system, has gone to jail.
Yeah, well, I'm blanking right now on the name of the movie, but my friend Charles Ferguson, who produced this film on the financial crisis and won the Academy Award for it last year.
Inside job.
He makes, I think, the important point that there was no one there. And, you know, when the financial crisis was raging, Richard Vague, sitting here in the studio, and I talked a lot, not about the question of who's to blame in there, but that the U.S. deal, the U.S. government deal with financial institutions essentially left stockholders whole and management in place, and really didn't put forward the thing where accountability was basically. And, you know, it's very ironic now to be arguing the fact that the American household that was essentially the consumer of these loans, they also should have, to some degree, a way out on this, because they were hit by forces much larger than they themselves could have ever have seen. And so the public interest, in my view, really rested with the ability to deal with that. And I found, I haven't actually talked to Richard about this, so I don't know his views. I found the financial crisis an incredibly lost opportunity to have rewired essentially the social compact between, you know, workers and capital and firms, and how you can basically restore a system that gets back to investment, to savings, and you know, move some of that forward, as opposed to just resuscitating what was the old system and bailing out. And it really irked me that, you know, there were 5,000 people at bailed-out institutions after that first year getting million-dollar bonuses or greater. So the way in which management was let off in these banks and institutions after the bailouts was criminal in my mind. But at the same time, it did not come with a quid pro quo that I think it should have. Let's clean out the rest of the market so that you can get this off and actually do something that is in the public interest, which is getting back the economy back in a firmer state that it can grow. And this is where Richard and I have really joined up come at this from different perspectives.
And what's interesting to me, too, and just going, and I don't want to relitigate the SNL crisis, but it is interesting that people did go to prison for that.
Right. It was a much smaller scale.
It was on a much smaller scale, indeed.
And that part of the problem is it's so big a scale, it's, you know, it's all of us kind of a thing. Now, I think there's something very important from a psychology standpoint about a boom, whether it was this one or others, is there is a lot of evidence. You know, it turns out to be false evidence, but there's a lot of evidence when you're in the middle of the boom that what you're doing is rational. So, importantly, as mortgage loans volumes were increasing, and mortgage loans outstanding went from $5 trillion to almost $10 trillion during the 2000s. In about 6 or 7 years, it went from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. That's staggering. But housing values, as estimated, as carried on the Fed's books, as your local appraiser would have found, housing values actually increased at a faster rate than that. That was fiction, we now know. It wasn't at the time. And I actually went in 2005-06 to the chief economist of an institution I was involved with and said, look how fast mortgage loans are rising. Isn't this a concern? And his response was, well, mortgage values and stock market values have gone up higher than that. So the consumer's balance sheet is actually in better shape than it was a few years ago. And that was literally true at that moment, as circular as that reasoning was and as specious as that logic was. And he said to me, and I'll take that trade any day of the week. Now, I'm an old credit card guy, and I realize, you know, to pay back a loan, you got to have cash.
Yes.
So, you know, it was run for the hills time. But there was plenty of evidence. And I guess my statement is people weren't trying to defraud anyone. People were caught up. They were making big bonus checks. There was evidence to support the valuations being turned. It happens again and again and again in our industrial age.
Well, and I think for that homeowner whose house, the value of their house went up, they were thinking, gosh, what a great investment
I
made.
I'm rich,
and I can take out a second loan. I can use my mortgage to do other things.
We lived in a just-in-time money world. I tell them, when you think about Toyota and the manufacturing where they had just-in-time production, I remember that you can do that because you have the trust that all of these components and pieces will be in the right place. We had just-in-time jobs, just-in-time money, just-in-time credit. For everyone, and to some degree, the level of trust that tomorrow, regardless of whether you kept your job or not, that you'd be able to find something else. Those were very heady times for the U.S. economy. It was just go capitalism, but it was in a way fake. And unfortunately, now we've gone so much the other direction. And what we would like to see is get back where hard work and earnest work generates economic growth, but people were living well beyond their means.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Steve Clemens and Richard Vague about debt, the economy, our political system, our financial system. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. They co-authored an article. It was in The Atlantic, How to Predict the Next Financial Crisis, that caught our attention. And we'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been raising money during the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we still have some work to do. Our thanks to everyone who made a pledge, but if you didn't, there's still time to do it. We rely on listeners just like you to fund the programs that you enjoy and turn to stay informed. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, and so will we. Thanks very much.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Ahead of the President's State of the Union address, job growth, a huge challenge. What's the view like for employers and workers? Also, from a jam session in a dorm room with John Mayer to fronting her own band, fiddler Carrie Rodriguez. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. So are we missing the forest for the trees by focusing so much on government debt and not private debt? According to a recent article co-authored by our guest, How to Predict the Next Financial Crisis, there's about $24 trillion or so in consumer and business debt held in the U.S. today, much more than the federal debt and our money supply. And it's raising questions about what to do about this debt. And that's what we're talking about with our guests, Steve Clemens and Richard Vague. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Steve, this is, of course, the morning before President Obama's going to give his State of the Union address tonight. What would you like? I mean, here we are talking about private debt. What would you like him to say tonight? Not that he's going to.
Well, he won't, but it'd be great to have him say, you know, we still have. I think if the President of the United States came out and said, we still have a major debt burden in the nation that is unfairly on the backs of working Americans and hardworking families, and we ought to square this, and let's move this. It was a historic economic gut punch that Americans took. Move that into a place where financial institutions and banks have a longer runway to write off that debt so that it does not undermine their solvency. Mm-hmm. So they can keep in the business of banking and finance. They get that off their books, but a new deal is struck. You could call it the New Deal.
I was going to say, I
and you could call it a New Deal struck, and that would be a fabulous thing. You can say this then generates economic activity immediately without, by the way, adding to the debt load of the nation. Right. This is the smart business way out of both growing the economy and not committing greater sins of adding to the government debt load. That would be a remarkable opener for President Obama tonight, where I hope to cover him tonight, the State of the Union.
But I wonder, Richard, let's say something like this were to happen. Is it clear that a homeowner, an individual person, would take that extra money and spend it in the economy? And of course, we know that the economy depends on consumer spending, and that's where the jobs come from. Would it work out that way, or might they?
They don't call them consumers for nothing.
Okay, because they consume.
And you know, whether they do it this quarter or next quarter or next quarter, which you know most folks are really micro focus in terms of time segments. As a general matter, consumers spend.
Yeah. And we need them to spend, but we need them to spend without going into deeper and deeper debt.
At an appropriately moderate pace.
Which, to me, Steve, raises questions about just the fact that so many households in this country, I think the median household income is around $50,000. That's not a lot of money to have a mortgage, to perhaps send your kids to college, take care of health care, have a car, pay your auto insurance. Seems to me it also makes sense to look at just people's incomes in this country and try to figure out how to increase those incomes.
Yeah, that's beyond my pay grade in terms of you know how to get those sorts of issues broadened. But what I do know is that for that person that may not have a lot of income, we found lots of ways to fake it so that they felt richer than they were.
Yeah.
And when you looked at the internet bubble and you looked at – we've been basically coasting from bubble to bubble to bubble. And as these bubbles burst, they really hit – the backs of these households. You saw 401ks, you know, collapse after the internet bubble in many cases. And, you know, what I've always found, I don't want to get into kind of a class warfare model here, but, you know, you take the top 1 or 2%, they somehow always seem to do okay. But it is these people who really drive so much of the consumption and GDP of the economy that that felt as if they could spend at levels that weren't sustainable because of what they perceived in the values of their homes and the values of maybe stock assets or retirement assets that they had. And those bubbles burst. And unfortunately, we don't have a very good way to compel and force those banks and financial institutions to do a new deal. And as you said, the Obama administration did a pretty poor job of getting out there on a mass basis and getting these
An estimated 10 or 11 million of the 55 million mortgages in the United States are underwater to some extent. And the programs that the White House sponsored touched maybe a few hundred thousand of those.
Yeah, which is and the sort of loss of assets is really just breathtaking. It seems when you look at someone who thought their house was a value of one level, and then they find it's worth much less.
Right, and they're still carrying that debt load. And and you know, we were at Richard and I were talking with some folks last night, and you know, it's a topic for another day. But I worry about other bubbles that are out there. The student loan problem is a substantial one. It's another form of large debt that people can't walk away from. Right. And again, you don't want to fall into the moral hazard sides of this, but there are basic fundamental social contract questions that I think we're not dealing with as a nation about what the quid pro quos are for responsible stakeholders as citizens that are trying to become educated, move along that path. And yet they have, through no fault of their own, had the rug pulled out beneath them on some of these debt problems. So I think that's mm-hmm. what we're trying to rectify.
We've been focusing largely on mortgage debt, but I wonder, Richard Vague, looking at credit card debt, and I wonder whether whether credit card companies bear some responsibility. Of, I remember when my son was still a teenager, and he personally would get letters in the mail from credit card companies, and they wanted to sign him up for a credit card, and he was in no position to be able to be a responsible credit card owner. Have we learned those lessons?
One of the interesting things relative to the credit card market is you actually were having funds leave the credit card market because mortgage lenders were being so aggressive with second lien loans, and those were tax deductible loans as opposed to credit card loans, which are not. So credit card loan growth during this entire period and even to the present has been relatively moderate, actually. A lot of that money went to the second lien mortgage lending market.
Because that's where the money was, that's where the profit was.
That's where the profit was. That's where you had the tax-exempt status, and that's where the action was.
Let me get to, it looks like Michael from Cape May to join us on Radio Times. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
A little under the weather. Very quickly, has there been an unintended consequence to two matters? Number one, the bankruptcy legislation changing in 2003, and what was the unintended consequence of ever expanding student loans to not keeping the cost down on private and public education university level? And I'll take the answers.
I hope
offline.
You feel better, Michael. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. You want to take that, Richard?
The unintended consequence was what was the question?
Well, it looks like he's looking at some of the bankruptcy rules that changed.
Yeah, okay, the bankruptcy law. I lived through that bankruptcy law change, okay. By the way. It was quite something. Was what in effect? I don't think the bankruptcy law change really amounted to much, except that everyone was so concerned about it that we had like 10x the number of bankruptcies leading up to that, and we actually had a clear out.
Anticipation of?
Yeah. So I actually don't. I like having a somewhat, even as a lifetime credit card lender, I always liked having a somewhat liberal, I like bankruptcy set of laws. I like having a safety valve in the system. People need to be able to clean their slate. Mm-hmm. And bankruptcy was something we just dealt with every day. Mm-hmm. It was part of the equation. I don't think that you're talking about less than a trillion dollars in this $25 trillion equation. So I don't think it's that big of an issue.
Thanks, Michael, for calling into Radio Times. Steve, anything you want
to
add to that?
I think it's very interesting, the question on the cost of education, which he poses, and what one can do given the skyrocketing cost of education, that when you leave the doors after you graduate and you go into the economy, you're not necessarily able to generate the returns to pay the loans and debt you did to just become. You're told every day that your salary and income will track with your educational level, and we've had this skyrocketing cost. The Atlantic hosted a forum with about, I guess there were 12, 13, 14 university presidents, some private universities. We had Jack DeJoy of Georgetown there, but also state universities. And the broad question of what are universities there for anymore? Are they credentialing institutions, or are they there for learning? And what are the quid pro quos? What are the, you know, the cost factors that go into this? And are you now driving your graduates to certain industries just so that they can afford to pay back, mm-hmm. and you're undermining the kind of broad health? I don't have answers to this. I think that you're seeing more moves of people asking these fundamental questions. And now you see with the internet, you see with technology, you see Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, actually talking about the fact that we need some efficiencies and some revolutions in our educational establishment to deal with this. Because if costs go crazy through the roof, you're going to find other ways on the internet and leveraging information out there for people to become educated take everything. But I think the question is exactly the right question. I just don't think we know as a society what the right answer is.
I think the problem is going to become much bigger because the need for lifetime learning is going to be a more and more substantial need, and in a non-trivial way. I mean, everything you know now is going to be obsolete 5 or 10 years from now, and it's been a luxury now. It's going to become a necessity as the world gets increasingly more complex, and financial institutions are having a crisis of their own because, you know, with the exception of a layer of ultra-prestigious universities, the very viability of universities in an age of internet education, internet curriculums, and the like is going to be called into question over the next relatively short period of time.
Living through some changes here. let me see what Christine from West Philadelphia has to say. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
My question is, I don't understand what is meant by restructuring. Let's take that example of the $150,000 house. Okay. Now it's worth $100,000. I don't understand how the $50,000 that's on the books of the mortgage company or the bank, how that turns. I don't understand why the bank or the mortgage company doesn't crash if there's a bunch of those.
It's a very good question, actually. Christine, can I toss that to you, Richard Vague?
Well, that's at the heart and soul of lending. And that, you know, at any time you make a loan, you put aside certain money with the expectation that part of the loans won't be repaid, and you build a loan loss reserve. And so, you know, if you have this $150,000 mortgage and you realize that the value of the home by an appraisal is only $100,000 and the customer can't afford the $150,000 loan, you may come to the judgment that you need to write off $50,000 of that, and you write it off against the reserve. That's a very fundamental operation within a lending institution that happens all the time. The issue here is that, by our estimate, $2.5 trillion in loans were made above a trend line, and you can suspect that a large number of those were bad loans. It may be 2/3 of that. And the capital within the banking system in the United States is only about $1 trillion. So
someone's got to make a difference.
The math doesn't work. Now, as I said early on, I guess only about 10 or 20% is actually in banks. So there's a lot of other institutions involved as well. But it's a big problem simply because of the scale.
But I think Christine is saying, okay, if that's the plan, and there's a certain reserve there, but it doesn't cover all the costs.
That's exactly what we're saying. That's why you give them a 20-year phase-in or a long period of time to be able to take pieces of that and write that off their books so that they don't undermine their solvency as an institution. That's exactly what our proposal is about.
And that's an extraordinary measure, but it's not an unprecedented measure. The regulators have done that from time to time through the course of my career.
Christine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I do want to segue into why you started the Iraq Study Group, and for a number of reasons. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the war in Iraq, begun in March of 2003, and I'm looking at you, Steve Clemens. Why did you team up with Richard Vague to start this group?
Well, actually, it was the Afghanistan Study Group.
I'm sorry, Afghanistan Study Group.
But we were worried about Iraq. We got it. You know, I'm somebody as a realist, as a Nixonian realist to some degree, I used to run the Nixon Center in Washington, had a lot of qualms about the invasion of Iraq and saw that as something that would eventually empower Iran. And you just looked at the region. And when you looked at Afghanistan, you had basically embedded in what was called counterinsurgency strategy, the notion which David Petraeus largely pioneered, instituted, did a great deal of writing and thinking about, that the larger deployment of U.S. military forces in these other cultures and societies will generate security deliverables and stability in a way and largely pacify and change the security dynamics of the country. And you know, there's a lot of folks we argued and we watched that as the U.S. forces grew and were deployed, the number of enemies, so-called Taliban, which used to be a rough, disorganized set of factions, grew right along this. So that the more you deployed, the more enemies we were actually facing, and our rivals went up. And we began saying, this is really taking us into a course where we were spending $120 billion a year in a country with a $14 billion GDP. So at the time, there were things like, you know...
Think about that.
You know, yeah, I was going to say, I'm digesting that.
And it was a bit crazy. And along with the whole kind of post-9/11 so-called global war on terror, you saw a lot of behaviors in Washington not being thought about, not being questioned, not being analyzed, not being challenged. Because if you did challenge, you paid a political risk. You were off, you know, you were off the funders list. You were, you know, disinvited from the White House Christmas party, whatever it could be. Not that that's, you know, what we all live for. But Richard Vague and I met at that time because he had concerns about this. And he wanted to organize a conference around the notion of how could you deal with these security questions in a way that was beyond bullets, and way, you know, not being so overzealous about always deploying the U.S. military to solve every problem out there. And we met,
Because it's so expensive.
Right.
Well, I only have a minute here, because, and I want to toss this to you, Richard Vague, because I asked you about good debt and bad debt. But when you look at these two wars, I guess we can put them, lump them together, good debt, bad debt. I mean, we're talking several trillion dollars.
You're talking probably $3 trillion, and it's $3 trillion we could have spent on rebuilding roads, rebuilding schools, paying down debt, you name it. Could have gone a lot of places that I think were way more productive than what we did.
You know, one quick data point, since 9/11, you know, the day before 9/11 hit, we have a figure of what we were spending to keep Americans safe in the country. And if you look what the bin Laden effect was, so you looked above the rate, including inflation, we've spent about $2.7 trillion just on defense, just in the defense category, above what we were spending before. That's about 6 million private sector jobs. So it has gotten to a point where if you have wars of that scale, you don't raise taxes to pay for them, you have a displacement effect in the U.S. economy that I think we're not yet really addressing. And in the private sector, that's at the level of, you know, incomes, about 6 million jobs.
Well, thank you so much for letting me pick your brain, brains, I should say, for the hour. Thanks very much, Steve Clemens.
Great.
And Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large at The Atlantic, also the publisher of The Washington Note. Richard Vague, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
He's managing partner of Gabriel Investments, and he also, I should add, is chairman of the board of the Philadelphia Live Arts and Fringe Festival.
Go Fringe
is what we say here on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.